Today on With Good Reason, the climate for small business in Virginia and the nation. I'm Carolyn Elliott. Percent of businesses in Virginia are small businesses with anywhere from 1 to 500 employees. Yet despite the fact that mom-and-pop operations and entrepreneurs have been called the backbone of the American economy, small businesses have traditionally felt beleaguered and constrained by government policy, particularly in the 1980s. But the small business community found a collective voice in 1993 when they opposed mandates for employers to pay for workers' insurance that were part of President Clinton's health care plan. Today, Republicans and Democrats alike are taking a pro-small business stance. In Virginia, Governor Allen signed a bill in April to reform the state's Business Professional and Occupational License Tax, or BPOL. A bill Allen says will help small businesses by removing or reducing this annual tax. Gerald Hughes is executive director of the Longwood Small Business Development Center. Michael Camp is a professor of management at James Madison University. They're my guests today. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Gerald Hughes, the BPOL tax reforms that Governor Allen signed are supposed to help small businesses flourish by eliminating or reducing this annual license tax that they have to pay. Is it going to work?
I think it's yet to be seen. But in many, especially smaller rural communities, the BPOL tax is a real workhorse, a real work engine, as far as supporting local services. And the loss of the BPOL tax, especially to small towns and counties, will have to be replaced in increased taxation elsewhere. And it's probably going to go to personal property and or real estate tax. And in some cases, that will be less fair than the BPOL tax has the potential to be an even greater burden on small, medium-sized businesses.
Professor Hughes, 99% of the businesses in Virginia are small businesses. What percentage of the revenue in the state, however, do small businesses bring in?
Again, it depends upon your term of small business, but using the over 500 employee as a perimeter, the smaller businesses, even though they account for 99% of registrations, only account for about 40% of total revenue generated.
So in the state of Virginia, about half of the employment and about half of the revenue is dependent on small businesses. Michael Camp, small businesses were hurting in the 80s, and now the Clinton administration has made them what one business magazine calls a favorite Washington cause. Is the climate today better for small businesses than it was a decade ago?
I guess it depends on the nature of the business you happen to find yourself in. Certainly, legislatively, we're finding a lot of improvements. The administrations, not only on one side or the other, Democratic or Republican, are both finding that the small business community is a very powerful community, a very well-organized community, certainly more so than in the past.
You're talking about as far as lobbying
sure,
is concerned.
Yeah, lobbying issues and just kind of binding together for some of the common causes that they have among themselves. So I think with respect to the legislative issues, you're seeing a lot of favoritism, but you're also seeing some problems that need very serious attention, and to the extent that they can get that, that would certainly serve small business in general as well.
Yeah, some of the major issues historically for smaller businesses in the frame of reference of inability to compete have dealt with government regulation and paperwork, environmental issues, and certainly from the beginning of the Clinton administration to the recent past has been the issue of health insurance and the provision of health insurance. I think the other part of that environment is a lot of big businesses are finding they can compete better if they operate as smaller businesses. And there are strong niches in certain industries where smaller is better.
We'll talk to and get to that in a little while. Let me go back to some of the legislation, though, because one of the chief complaints, and I got this from your survey, Gerald Hughes, that businesses have is that they have a hard time accessing capital. The Clinton administration has made that easier. Is that true? Is it easier now for a small business to get startup funds than it used to be?
That's a rather gray area, but yes, they have done some things. which in certain situations, especially for the smaller small business to access funds. One of the platforms which the American voter heard strong and clear during the Clinton campaign was that he desired to put character back into the loan equation and to carry forward on
character that. Of the borrower,
yes.
Is what he meant.
Yes.
Okay.
And to carry forward on that promise, he used the Small Business Administration and developed a new loan guarantee program, normally referred to as the low-doc loan. They're both low and no documentation loans. And that referred to the amount of paperwork necessary for the loan. For loan guarantees of less than $50,000, it's a single-page front and back application. For loan guarantees between $50,000 and $100,000, it's a three-page application.
Now, is that considerably simplified from what it was before?
Yes.
Okay. So it's easier to apply for a loan now?
Yes. And the lender, the bank, can transmit those to the district office of the SBA by fax and can expect to receive an answer within 3 days. However, in order to provide the information necessary for a loan decision, even on one page or three pages, it's extremely important that the potential business owner or existing expanding business has completed a business plan in anticipation of being able to support the credibility of their application.
But isn't that as it should be? I mean, isn't the government taking undue risk otherwise in guaranteeing these loans?
It's probably as it should be. Unfortunately, you find that about 80 to 85% of the businesses of that size and stature don't do business planning, and they don't do it very well.
Is it fair to demand that a small business of maybe one or two people does do a business plan? Is that a...
I think it's absolutely fair.
Okay.
If they're applying for loan monies of any sort, whether it be federal, state, or some other private source, these businesses actually need hand-holding, need some type of assistance, and so they need to be made aware of that as well. Along with the changes in process, there need to be some changes in how we assist businesses in providing the right documentation.
I want to get back very briefly to the character issue, though, because this is one of the more interesting things, I think, that's happened, and that is there are four criteria for taking out a loan. One of them is your collateral, and one of them is your character as a person, your resume, your background. And Clinton has increased the emphasis on character and lowered the emphasis on collateral.
Yes. Basically, the four areas are the business idea. Do you have a market for your product or service, and can you fill that market at a profit? There's the ability to assume risk or a determination of who in this business would be assuming risk for the capital that's necessary to create to support it. Also, the ability of the business to cash flow or repay debt and or equity investment, and the ability of management and or the character of the management of the business. And in the low documentation loan program, the determination was made to put a much stronger emphasis on the fourth, the character, credit worthiness of the individual and or individuals in the business, but not require that the business owner or owners be able to assume all of the risk themselves. With the low documentation loans, it's not necessary that the borrower be able to fully collateralize the loan. The availability of 100% collateral or the unavailability of 100% of collateral is not a valid reason for turning the loan down. However, if you have the collateral, you will have to provide it to secure the loan.
Well, let me ask you, when you start that first small business, from your experience, Gerald Hughes, where are the areas that are real growth areas right now?
Anything that makes use of information and knowledge, and especially
so
technology.
So still service technology industry?
Well, not really. The area in which we provide most of our service, that being South Central Virginia, that has historically been a manufacturing region. Unfortunately, it became a manufacturing region because companies moved in to take advantage of displaced, very inexpensive, very unskilled farm labor. So the region attracted what I call commodity industries. textiles, clothing, furniture, wood products, those jobs that where they were looking for strong backs and weak minds.
Mm-hmm.
And not really taking advantage of the labor, it kept the quality of life, standard of living rather low. But in the void that has been created by those jobs moving offshore and to other countries with lower wages and lower standards of living, kind of out of the ashes, have arisen people with knowledge of the industry and the products who are using new technology, which allows them to be much, much more productive with higher tech equipment. And they're competing in niche markets now using the skills of that traditional labor and being extremely successful doing it. So even in manufacturing, we see really strong niches. Anywhere people have information.
What determines whether or not one of these small businesses is going to make it? We hear about a very high failure rate, and there are all kinds of statistics out there for your risk factors. And one that I pulled up, which I thought was rather interesting, independent firms, sole proprietorships, and firms owned by women have lower than average growth and success rate.
Our experience in the 1,500 some odd businesses we've worked with over the last 8 years would not necessarily support the contention that women-owned businesses are less successful than male-owned businesses. Quite the contrary. I know that in past years, within the last 5 years, females have opened businesses in numbers up to 7 times greater than male owners in the same period. And I have seen statistics that show that over 50% of all businesses in the U.S. will be owned by females by the year 2001.
Hmm.
Particularly small businesses.
Well, one recommendation in all the literature for success in small business is growth, keeping your business growing. And what if you don't want to do that? What if you want to keep the business small, you want to keep it manageable? Does that make it tough to compete?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. If the business is not, we have a saying in the classroom as we work students through the program, and that if the business isn't growing, if it's not moving forward, then it's definitely moving backward. There is no status quo in today's industries, in today's marketplaces. And when we say growth, too, it's not always growth for growth's sake. If the goals and intentions don't have the traditional growth aspects to them, growth in revenues, growth in profits, growth in other dimensions, then growth would take a secondary place. And yet growth in terms of culture, growth in terms of ability to anticipate change in the marketplace, growth in terms of the knowledge base that the entrepreneur is working with within their people, that type of growth, it cannot stop. It cannot ever meet a status quo and assume that we have arrived now.
But the firm doesn't necessarily have to want to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I personally don't think so. I personally don't see that it's necessary that the business want to get large for large sake. One of the reasons we were talking about downsizing were all the reasons and negatives against being a large organization, the bureaucracies associated with it, the inflexibility, the restrictions, and just that size actually brings with it.
Gerald Hughes?
A lot of very excellent business ideas, people who were ahead of the curve and got into a new niche and did extremely well.
Example being?
In the information age areas and in certain service areas that involve technology and in some cases even basic consumer product manufacturing. You see a transition in, if not ownership, leadership at some point in time if the company is to survive. And I agree very much with Michael. We tell folks that a business can do two things. It can grow or it can die. There is no static situation. You cannot stay status quo. But on the other end of that, a company will often grow past the capacity of the current owner's management ability, and there is a time when they need to sell out, or maybe they want to. A lot of people want to grow a business large, sell it out, and go do something else.
Well, I think one of the best examples of the disparity between very big and growth oriented and small and want to stay that way is what's happening in a lot of small towns now with Walmarts, and I'm assuming the same thing happens with Kmart. So you've got a small town with a lot of retail establishments downtown, at one of these businesses comes in on the outskirts of town and the small businesses in town go out of business. And people who are in rural areas that own retail shops, they own it because they enjoy the business, but they also enjoy the way of life, you know, Monday through Friday, open a few hours on Saturday, employing people in town. Do these people have any chance against the Walmarts? What's the status of this situation right now?
In order to compete, they've got to, and stay competitive over the long haul, they've got to adopt some of the things that we were just talking about momentarily, was the things of looking for improvements, looking for innovations. And one of the things I like to focus on with the group that I work with primarily, being retail and service-based, information processing-based organizations, is the constant need to define the value that you provide in your business to your customer. And if you're a small shop located downtown, Harrisonburg or wherever it might happen to be, and there's a Walmart or Kmart open up on the outside of town, you've got to know ahead of time, not after the fact, but ahead of time, what is it that distinguishes your product, your service in the market? Is it the quality of the convenience, the fact that you're more convenient? Is it that your prices are more fair and more generate more value for the customer? Do you have specific products that the customer is no longer going to be able to find at the Walmarts or Kmart?
Well, for the most part, you're not going to be most convenient. For the most part, if you're a pharmacy, you're probably not most convenient if you're downtown because there's not a huge parking lot there. Your prices probably are not going to be better. There was a lawsuit over this in Georgia, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you respond when these people say, look, this big guy is coming in and deliberately trying to wipe me out of business?
Well, I think the key question here is, in the Walmart situation, is there any market left at all or not? And I think what Michael's saying is there enough market left in your retail market area for you to provide complementary goods and goods at the bottom end or the upper end of those provided by Walmart? And a lot of this comes down to the difference between the Walmart big rural store and the Walmart superstore. A Walmart is the traditional Walmart, as most of Virginia's rural communities have seen up until the last few months, has been a 60 to 110,000 square foot department store with a large variety of goods and, of course, excellent prices. On the other hand, the Super Walmart is 160 to 190,000 square foot mammoth concrete block building in which consumer dollars enter and never come out again. They have a full service grocery store, usually optical shops, dry cleaners, florists, so on and so on and so on. And those businesses are not going, in most cases, to enlarge the market area. So each new dollar that goes into the cash register at the Super Walmart is going to come out of the cash register of a locally owned store.
Well, it seems like what we're addressing here is how small businesses, retail, can compete. Are the small retail businesses in big trouble in the United States?
Personally, I don't think so. I think they're in big trouble under the traditional model. If there's a small business that happens to maintain that they can do business the same way they've been doing business for the last 10 years and going to be able to maintain competitiveness in the marketplace, Jerry's comments are right on, that that's really not likely to happen, that they're going to see decline and we're going to see a loss in our communities of those types of organizations that, and again, Jerry pointed out, that bring a lot of value over and above just the products that they're happen to be marketing at the time. But I think that the businesses who do recognize that change is on the horizon, that they do need to adapt some of these other philosophies and principles and ways of doing business to be more proactive, to be more astute as to what's happening in the marketplace, to be more aware of their customer needs and how their customer needs drive the way in which they ought to structure the business, these types of things, those businesses will find a niche for themselves in these marketplaces. I know another thing that bothers me, too, about the push for large organizations, and I know there's lots of emphasis for jobs-wise and tax revenue base and that side to bring these larger organizations in, is the lack of customer service. And I see it over and over, regardless if it's a small rural community or if it's a larger metropolitan area, that the loss of customer service is a significant negative dimension, negative aspect of seeing lots of retail move into the larger mega stores.
Gerald Hughes, where do you see small business going in the next 20 years? Are there going to be a lot of changes? And we'll throw into the mix with something you mentioned earlier, which was telecommuting. With technology and access to the World Wide Web, you can almost operate a business now out of your home with not a whole lot of overhead.
Absolutely.
And not almost.
When you began your question, that was the answer. Technology will change it drastically. And I think one of the key points, and Michael hit upon it too, you used to be able to have the drugstore or the department store and a corner location in your downtown, and that was good for 20 years, 30 years. The life cycle for a business idea and a niche is now more like 18 months. You know, in the early 80s, it was down to maybe 5 years. And this also goes back to the idea of growth, whether it be
You're saying they go out of business in 18 months?
I say that their idea and their niche has collapsed and or they have attracted competition and their potential for being profitable has already contracted within 18 to 24 months in most cases.
Michael Camp and Gerald Hughes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
You're listening to With Good Reason. I'm Carolyn Elliott. As Republicans call for continued cuts in the size of government, states are experimenting with turning some of their traditional responsibilities over to the private sector. Here to talk about this privatization trend and its impact on small business is Granville Sawyer, Associate Professor of Management at Norfolk State University. Professor Sawyer, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Governor Allen and government in general is calling for private organizations to take over more and more government responsibilities. And in Virginia, we've got a private road project going now with another in the works. Food service operations for government office buildings are being taken over by private industry. And there's a call to get rid of in-house printing and to ship that out. Does the trend toward government privatization, Professor Sawyer, open up opportunities for small business entrepreneurs?
I think it does. It opens up opportunities for both existing businesses and also for startup businesses. I feel that privatization is going to not only grow businesses, but literally create industries, primarily at this point in the high-tech fields, where there is so much technology in the public domain created for military purposes, for aerospace purposes, that the government is spending literally almost $1.5 billion a year to transfer into the private sector. I think the important thing to consider when we talk about privatization, however, is whether or not the idea of privatization is really feasible for the given project that we're discussing. I think that's what's most important, because if that's not true, it's going to be difficult to make any sort of arrangement in the private sector work. In my opinion, I think that what we need to consider is whether or not the public is best served.
So it's not always a win-win situation.
I think if it's done right, it's always a win-win situation. It's only when it's not done correctly. And the thing that I think is important to remember is that if you privatize a function or a technology, that private business is a for-profit business. And its primary objective is concentration of capital. Whereas in the public sector, a local, state, regional, or federal government organization does not have that as its primary motivation. Its motivation is to serve the people that are in its jurisdiction. And I think it's the same way with services, be they public schools or prisons or whatever.
Well, you mentioned schools, though, and that has been one of the experimental areas for privatization. You don't feel that that would work in a public school.
The experiments certainly have been mixed. The only one I really know a lot about is the one in Boston. I think Boston College took over a school district in the Roxbury section of Boston. And they weren't very successful at it. In fact, I think they may have given up on that already. So in a situation like that, if you're going to turn your schools over to a for-profit organization, you got to ask why. Are you doing this to save money? Is that your primary objective? Or is your primary objective to provide the best education possible? And who's best to do that?
Let's get specific to Virginia. We have had one highway project that has been privatized. They're talking about a second and possibly a third. Ultimately, for the citizens of the Commonwealth, did that turn out for the good, or was it a wash, or was it an ultimate loss for the people of Virginia?
I think the jury's still out on that. The privatization itself, I think, has been so recently done that we're still going to have to look at more data before we know for sure whether or not this particular project is going to be useful. This is really something that's still relatively new. It is not. We haven't been at this for a long time.
When a small business takes over a government project, it's something that's privatized, how does the reporting structure change? Because if it's a government agency, they have certain Freedom of Information laws that they have to follow. They're very accountable to the public. If the government privatizes something, does that company have the same accountability, or are they no longer accountable to the public?
I think one of the things that happens as a result of privatization is, to some extent, you lose the absolute openness associated with an organization that is paid for and operated with taxpayer dollars. There are certainly freedom of information laws on the books that focus on consumers being able to access information like that. But in a private sector organization, naturally, there's going to be a little bit less of that. So I think when you have a private sector organization providing the public with a service, then one has to consider, especially in a monopolistic or oligopolistic situation, whether or not there should be some regulation of this business in order to ensure that the public good is still being served. I think that's particularly true, for instance, if we're talking about a privatizing a utility in Great Britain. Margaret Thatcher privatized a number of the utilities, the water companies and others, but there's still government regulation. So I think in areas where the public good must be served, if that requires some external regulation of this private business, then that's entirely appropriate.
What happens to the tax structure? Because the other thing that happens when privatization occurs is that ultimately you're going to lose jobs in Virginia. Highway workers, let's say, are no longer going to have that highway job. And there has been, in at least a couple of instances of privatization, the contract has been shipped out of the state to Michigan in one case. Right.
Well,
so it seems like there's a loss there.
Well, I think this gets back to what we were talking about before in terms of how the focus shifts when you go from public to private. If making money means I've got to take the jobs out of the state, you gave this project to me because you wanted it run more efficiently. Well, this is the most efficient way I can run it.
What happens to a lot of the required hiring practices? That's got to be a concern, I would think, because the state is better at hiring minorities, et cetera, affirmative action programs, and small businesses through privatization are not going to be required, right, to maintain that same kind of hiring. Is that a concern?
Well, I think as a person of color, I'm always concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that we're in an environment today where affirmative action programs are under scrutiny every day. And I don't necessarily feel that going from public to private guarantees anything, either good or bad.
We also have a situation for construction projects where there is an incentive to subcontract to minority businesses. That's not going to be there, right, if it's privatized?
If by that you're talking about the 8A or 8A set-aside program.
Exactly.
If all of that is privatized, then the private organizations are not abound as the federal government would be. But then you have to understand and remember that the person paying the bills is a federal or state government, even though the service is being provided for them by someone else. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't mean that the private service provider can pay no attention to what the state or the federal government feels is an appropriate approach to hiring minorities in the business.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Granville Sawyer is an associate professor of management at Norfolk State University. You're listening to With Good Reason. We'd like to hear your comments on the show. Our email address is reason@pcmail.chev, that's schev.edu. Our executive producer is Michael McDowell. Carolyn Elliott is the producer. Andy Washburg is our associate producer. We had research assistance from Carrie Pfeiffer, and Kevin Piccini composed our theme music. This program was produced with the help of WCVE Richmond. Thanks also to WHRV Norfolk and the University of Virginia.
With Good Reason is produced for the Virginia Higher Education Broadcasting Consortium by the State Council of Higher Education and public radio stations serving Virginia. The views expressed are not necessarily those of the Council, the Consortium, or this station. To comment on today's program or to receive tapes or transcripts, call toll-free 1-800-245-2434 or email us at reason@pcmail.schev.edu.